Susan Moran.
And I'm Gretchen Wetstein. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, February 5th, 2019.
Coming up, a topic for all Colorado athletes out there or weekend warriors, journalist Christy Eschwanden will discuss her new book. It's called Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery.
If you think it's a good idea to take ibuprofen before a workout, you might want to keep listening.
We begin with a bit of recent science news.
Among the other damaging impacts of climate change, it might make vector-borne diseases expand their geographical reach and put half the world's population at risk for a food crisis. A new study shows that high ambient temperatures dampen immune responses in mice infected with viral pathogens. Until now, it's been unclear how environmental temperature and nutritional status affects how a host defends itself against viral infection. Japanese researchers at the University of Tokyo compared the immune responses of mice kept at 22 degrees Celsius, or 72 degrees Fahrenheit, and 36 degrees Celsius, that's 97 degrees Fahrenheit, beginning 7 days prior to infection with the influenza virus. Compared with mice kept at room temperature, mice that were exposed to heat ate less and lost about 10% of their body weight. They also showed a decrease in lung T cells and impaired antibody and T cell responses. Exposure to heat also impaired immune responses in mice that were infected with either Zika virus or a pathogenic tick-borne virus that causes severe fever with thrombocytopenia syndrome. When heat-exposed mice were injected with either glucose or short-chain fatty acids, those are metabolites produced by gut microbes, their secretion of T cells and antibody responses was enhanced. The findings suggest that outside temperature and nutritional status may be critical determinants of how effective vaccines are in tropical or developing countries. What's more, the clinical management of emerging infectious diseases in these countries may require nutritional supplementation beyond antiviral therapy. The study was just published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science.
Tuberculosis, MRSA. These are just a few of the multi-drug-resistant microbes that threaten human health. Despite the increase of microbial resistance to drugs in the last several decades, the development of new antimicrobial treatments is practically at a standstill. But the recent discovery of a novel antifungal compound called cyphomycin reflects a promising new source of antimicrobials. Insects! Yes, you heard that right. We're using bugs to fight bugs. Research from the University of Wisconsin-Madison collected over 2,500 insects from North and South America and sampled their microbiomes in the hopes of finding new antibiotics. The insects collected, including bees, ants, and beetles, were home to more than 10,000 types of bacteria. Excitingly, the scientists discovered that several of these strains of bacteria could effectively kill drug-resistant microbes like E. coli and MRSA. One bacterium, isolated from a Brazilian ant, was especially powerful at killing fungi. The bacterium, a strain of Streptomyces, is the source of the newly discovered antifungal cyphomycin. Researchers used cyphomycin to effectively treat fungal infections in mice with minimal side effects, making it a promising potential therapy for humans. Although cyphomycin is being fast-tracked into drug trials, it is still far from being employed in the clinic, as many potential therapeutics fail during development. Nonetheless, the microbes on our creepy crawly insect friends may be key to developing new antimicrobials in the future. The study, led by Dr. Cameron Curry, was published last week in the journal Nature Communications.
And on the Front Range Science calendar this week, there's several laser and liquid light shows at the Fisk Planetarium at the University of Colorado Boulder. David Bowie fans will love this. On Thursday, February 7th, from 9 to 10 p.m., you can watch trippy visuals digitally rendered live while listening to David Bowie and other rhythms in the dome, all in surround sound. And then, Friday night, February 8th, another Liquid Sky event at the Fisk Auditorium will feature music from the British rock band Coldplay. That's from 9 to 10. And at 10:30 for the Night Owls, there'll be a surreal play of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon while you're watching, virtually, the moon and plenty else up there. For more info on these immersive Under the Digital Stars events, visit colorado.edu/FISKE, F-I-S-K-E. If you live on the Front Range, you probably spend a good amount of time outdoors exercising, running, skiing, rock climbing, cycling, or indoors weight training, crossfitting, and so on. Some of you, no doubt, are competitive, even pro athletes. So, you likely pay attention to the latest developments in exercise performance and recovery products and services. Gatorade, other sports recovery drinks, to compression boots, to cryo chambers, to good old-fashioned massages. The feverish pace and pitch of the new products and services designed to make you the best athlete possible is actually dizzying. You may wonder, for good reason, how solid the science is behind many of these claims. Our guest today is a former pro cyclist, runner, and skier, and she's a science journalist who's been diving into these questions. Christy S. Wandon has many tips and surprises in her book, based on scientific research. The new book is just published today, and it's called Good to Go: What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Christy, who's the lead science writer at 538, will speak about her book tonight at the Boulder Bookstore at 7:30. And she'll speak tomorrow night in Fort Collins at the Old Firehouse Books, starting at 6. Christy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here, because back in the late 90s, the very first thing that I ever did as a science writer was work on the show. So it's a pleasure to return. It feels sort of like full circle here.
That's great. And Christy reminded me that actually KGNU used to be at a different location before I came.
It did.
So I wanted to start, not all exercise is alike, obviously. Both length and intensity, mm-hmm. Not all athletes are alike, not all of us are athletes, period. So are you writing this book mainly for competitive athletes, or for really anyone who does some exercise and wants to take care of their body and mind?
Oh, this book is for everyone, and it really is not only something that's relevant to elites. In fact, I would say it may even be more helpful for people who are weekend warriors or people that are exercising, you know, just for health and for fitness, not necessarily competitive. There's a lot of wisdom here, I think, for people of all abilities and sort of things that they're doing.
And why maybe even more so for those kind, because they may not know as much as some of the competitive athletes?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. I think just understanding what they can do to get more out of their workouts and to make sure that these are, you know, this exercise that they're doing is making them feel better and getting them stronger, healthier, getting all of the benefits. Recovery is a really important part of that.
Yeah, so it's fascinating to me, including in the course of reading your book, how clear it is that science is in a way not a noun, but a verb. Like constantly, it's changing. Not that it was bad. I mean, some of it's bad, mm-hmm. but namely, it's iterative. So I'm curious, in 10 years, give an example of something you think we will look back at and go, I can't believe athletes were practicing this or downing this every day as part of their regime. Not only is it moot, but perhaps harmful.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think right now we're at a time, you mentioned this noun versus verb, and in the book I talk about how when I was a competitive athlete, recovery was really a noun. It was something you waited for. It was all the things you weren't doing. You were resting. You were putting your feet up. You were relaxing. Now recovery has really become a verb. It's something that people do. They have to do the foam roller. They have to do the ice baths. And we did have ice baths back in my day. That's a pretty old thing. But there are all these new devices and things, and the pneumatic compression pants and things, where people can end up spending just as much time as they spent working out actually doing these recovery rituals.
To say nothing of all the money they're spent. So just the gist of it, I'm really curious, because you said back in my day, you know, it was really put your legs up and rest, maybe even have a glass of wine or beer,
right?
Which we'll talk about later.
But, yes, we will.
But so our athletes, are we any better off now for all the products and services that we're go downing?
Yeah, I guess in the book, I kind of argue that, you know, if you are doing so many things and recovery has become something that's sort of its own source of stress, it's really counterproductive. And one of the things I talk about in the book, there's an entire chapter sort of about the mental and psychological aspect of recovery. So your body really, you know, to your body, stress is stress. And so your workout and your exercise is a sort of physical stress. But any kind of emotional, psychological stress is also felt by the body as stress in a similar way. And so your body doesn't really care whether it's stress because work is difficult or you're having problems at home, or if it's from a really hard workout, you know, it's going to release cortisol in the same sort of way. And so your body has to cope with these things and has to recover from them. And so I think it's a really common mistake that athletes will sort of discount the emotional stress and the psychological and the sort of, you know, the things that we normally just call stress, right, in their lives. So they say, well, I took a rest day because I didn't do a workout, but I was running around doing these stressful things and I was dealing with a really stressful situation that had me all worked up. And so that's not resting, and that's impeding recovery.
Yeah, well, then I'll jump into what I think is a really interesting, intriguing way that you describe in the book, a practice called flotation.
Yes.
Decades ago, it was called sensory deprivation chambers or whatever. That sounded torturous.
Oh, yeah. No, it's totally been rebranded because, you know, sensory deprivation sounds like torture, but floating sounds quite pleasant, doesn't it?
So describe briefly what it is and what it was like for you, and what does the science show
as to
how it's effective, if at all?
Yeah. So you're basically get into a little, there are different devices and I've tried out numerous types. A lot of them are just little pods that you get into that it's quite, you know, if you're claustrophobic, you probably think, oh, I won't like this. That's what I was thinking. I thought, I'm going to hate this. I'm doing it just for the book. This is sort of me being an immersive journalist and sometimes my job isn't
researcher.
So fun. Yeah. I mean, I really didn't think I was going to make it the first hour that you get into this. And there's, what's really interesting too, is that there's not that much water. You're floating in what is, you know, essentially just a few inches of water, but because it's so salty, you're very buoyant. And this buoyancy and this floating just feels extremely pleasurable, I think, because it really feels like a weightlessness. And ideally, it's dark in there. It's quiet. So you know, sensory deprivation is really a good way of describing it, because you're just sort of alone in your body floating. And what I found was it was a phenomenal way to just sort of disengage from all the stresses. It was a way of relaxing both body and mind. And I really kind of think of it as forced meditation. And so I know meditation is good. I've tried it. When I manage to do it, it's really great, but it can be hard if you're a monkey brain like me. And so I've just found that floating is a really effective way to do that, sort of get into that meditative state.
And what does the science show as to what it's doing? Like other things, you know, maybe for some it's a walk in the woods or look at paintings at a museum.
Right.
Kind of similarly working on balancing the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, that's right. So the science shows that it's pretty good at that sort of balancing those two systems. There are a lot of, you know, really outlandish claims made about floating. You know, the first place that I went to had a whole bunch of, they had a little video and it was talking about, you know, all of this sort of amazing effects that it was doing with hormones and blah, blah, blah. And I found the science didn't really pan out on a lot of that. At the same time, I think one of the sort of big takeaways from my book is that at its core, what recovery is really rest and relaxation. And so anything that helps relax, that's recovery. I mean, it's almost by definition, you're recovering when you're relaxing like that.
I think you should repeat that.
Yeah.
For the athletes out there who are like, oh my God. And you even say in your book something like, rest is anathema and it's conflated with slackiness and you know, non-competitiveness or...
Yeah.
But you're saying that rest, not just, as we'll get into, some of the techniques of recovery beyond that is absolutely important.
Oh, it's absolutely important. I mean, that's when your body is doing all these things that happen during recovery, which is making repairs, repairing the damage that's done during a hard workout. It's where you're making adaptations. You know, if you are training in hopes of getting fitter, faster, stronger, those adaptations happen during the recovery phase. You're not actually getting stronger as you are lifting the weight. You're getting stronger afterwards when your body is sort of responding to that stress that you presented it with to sort of bolster itself so that it's more prepared for the next bout.
So let's say you're not necessarily a competitive athlete, but you like to do something almost every day. What generally, or is there a general ratio of rest to exercise that's healthy?
That's a great question. And there isn't like a specific absolute rule there. I think, you know, one of the things I say in the book is the most important skill that any athlete can develop is the ability to read their own body and to understand the signals and cues it's giving them and to understand what it feels like to be recovered and what, you know, the kind of fatigue feels like that's your body saying, look, I need some more rest. And so a lot of this is really paying attention to your body, paying attention to, am I responding to this exercise? How am I feeling afterwards? If you're in a situation where more exercise is just making you more tired and run down, then that's really a cue that it's time to take a break.
Yeah, fascinating. So let's jump into some of the, well, initially, some of the more commonly used technique, shall we say, for recovery. And one of them I want to bring up is ibuprofen.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been taught by so many before tennis play it, especially of my age.
Right.
You may as well take some during, you may as well take it after. Obviously, there is a sense of too much, but you look at some really interesting science on this that's sort of cautionary.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So a lot of athletes love taking, they're called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. These are things like ibuprofen, Aleve, aspirin. And in fact, I remember when I was a high school athlete runner, you know, some of my friends on the track team would take ibuprofen like sort of prophylactically before workout with the idea like I'm going to become less sore, you know, things are going to hurt less. And it is true that these drugs are great painkillers, so you may feel less pain. But it's interesting. So you would think that because they are, I mean, literally in their name, it's anti-inflammatories, you would think, okay, we've sort of been trained to think that our inflammation is bad. But what I learned while researching this book is that inflammation is actually a crucial part of the adaptive process here.
And it depends on when, right? So you're talking at the early stage of an injury, say, or when is inflammation?
Okay, so injuries are a little bit different thing, but I'm talking here about sort of regular, just things like soreness and things like this. And in these cases, inflammation is part of the process of your body getting stronger. So you need that inflammatory response in order to make your muscles stronger, to repair the damage that you're doing from a hard workout. So if you're lifting weights with hopes of getting stronger muscles, it's that inflammatory process that helps you rebuild that damage that you do with the workout that makes you stronger. So anything that you're doing that's sort of tamping down inflammation is actually counterproductive. But the other thing that's interesting is that there's also some sort of, it's still somewhat preliminary, but it's very intriguing evidence that taking anti-inflammatory drugs may actually impede recovery from injuries and sort of repair of injuries and will reduce this adaptive response that you're looking for. So if you're an athlete, you know, there's all these products that are marketed as anti-inflammatory and you have to, you know, reduce inflammation. And it's like, no, wait a second. Actually, inflammation is good. I mean, you don't want to be walking around with like a gigantically swollen ankle or something because you twisted it. But, you know, if you're doing a hard workout, a little bit of inflammation, that's what's going to help you, your body respond and make those repairs that will get you better and stronger and fitter for the next time.
So it sounds like overall, stay away from it. But when, like what kind of cases is it actually
I would say useful? It's good when you're really in a lot of pain. It's a great painkiller. And if you are, you know, in a situation where you have a lot of pain and you need to address the pain, then it's a good thing. But just realize that you may be compromising this recovery a little bit.
I'm going to take a little station break. For those of you who joined us here on KGNU Science Show, our guest is journalist Christy Ashwanden discussing her new book called Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. So let's jump to something else that so many people take, and there's so many different versions of it, and that is supplements, multivitamins.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of snake oil there. There's a lot of pseudoscience there. Yeah. And there's some legitimate science there, right?
Yeah. So I have a whole chapter in the book about supplements. And I would just say, if my book convinces one person to to stop taking supplements, I will die happy. supplements are, I think most people don't realize that supplements are very loosely regulated, if they're regulated at all. And in fact, the U.S. Anti-Doping Association, or I'm sorry, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, which is the, you know, the group that does drug tests for athletes, they actually have a huge educational program going on right now to try and inform athletes, because there are so many athletes who are testing positive for doping products because they are taking supplements that are tainted. Mm. And the issue here is the sourcing. And so there's this idea that, well, if you just use a good brand, or you can tell like this one is okay, whereas others aren't. But if you know anything about how the ingredients are sourced and how they're produced, it's just really hard to know what you're getting. And the other thing is, when you look at the science, these things really aren't necessary and they don't seem to be helpful. And so a lot of it, I mean, this is an area where the marketing has just really, really overtaken the science. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I discovered is that these companies that make them, they really exploit this FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out. So it's the idea, if you're a top athlete, you really want to do everything you can to be at your best.
Next to me is taking him, I must too.
Exactly. And so they've really fostered this idea that, like, this is a part of being a top athlete and you need to take this. And I don't think that most athletes think, oh my God, if I take this supplement, this is the key. And, you know, here's my gold medal in the bottle. But it's more like, well, I want to make sure there's nothing that I've left on the table that I could have done that I didn't. And so it just perpetuates this idea that everyone's doing it. And, you know, in the book, I have stories about some triathletes who tested positive from taking an electrolyte tablet. There have been multivitamins that have tested people positive. There have been protein powders that have been found to have heavy metals and things and other products. So, like, you really don't know what you're getting. You don't know what's in there. And it really doesn't trump real food.
Yeah. And so another broad area, talk about explosion of marketing and products, is the energy drinks.
Yeah.
And for that matter, the electrolyte drinks, whether it's Gatorade or Spark or Advocare, you know, basically a lot of them have a lot of sugar, a lot of salt, a lot of caffeine. Mm-hmm. Are they all snake oil?
Well, so one thing that I talk about in the book, it's really interesting. We've really been, what's happened is the marketing has convinced us that hydration is this really complicated thing. It's really, really crucial. And it's like your body's living in this very delicate balance. And particularly, you know, exercise just creates these extraordinary demands on the human body. But when you think about it, what's extraordinary is the sedentary lifestyle that so many of us are living now. You know, our bodies are actually, you know, have evolved to exercise and to move. And so the idea that, you know, your body cannot handle exercise and you have to have this, you know, almost IV tube of liquids in order to perform is a little bit ridiculous. But it turns out that the science actually shows that we are well adapted to being able to lose some fluids during exercise. Now, look, I'm not saying don't drink, but really, you can drink to thirst and it will be okay. You don't need some special formula. You don't need special, you know, formulations of things. Do you know what electrolytes are? That's salts. Mm-hmm. Like, we get to, you know, on the one hand, your doctor's maybe telling you eat less salt. On the other, the sports drink company is telling you, you need these electrolytes. They're really important. You know, it's very confusing to people. But really, the research shows that if you're eating normal meals and drinking water and drinking fluids to thirst, you're going to be fine.
So we talk about evolution and our bodies have adapted. There are so many athletes around this area in Colorado who are well beyond evolution, beyond the pace. And so what about for those who are literally running for days on these ultra races? And I just heard from a friend on Sunday while skiing that her brother nearly died or collapsed from, seems like dehydration, not the tissue collapse. And I don't know exactly what collapse, but in extreme examples for athletes, should there be a lot more electrolyte intake during,
so the
if
current,
not after?
The current best practices, so there's a group, the Ultra Endurance, there's a sort of scientific group that studies ultra endurance exercise, and their current best practices are to drink to thirst and to eat, you know, some normal food during these events, which people do, and that is enough, that there is not a need for special electrolytes separately, and that there's no, you don't need to drink to some formula. There's also been this idea that you need to weigh yourself before and after, and if you're losing, you know, certain percentage of your body weight during the event, that's really dangerous. Mm. But it turns out that what's dangerous is drinking too much. I was unable, while working on this book, to find a single instance of someone dying dying of dehydration during an athletic event, but what has happened is people are dying from overhydration, also called water intoxication. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you drink so much fluid that your blood becomes too dilute and your brain swells, and it's a terrible thing. And so this sort of rush to convince people that hydration, it's really complicated and important and you have to drink, is actually killing people. Whereas, you know, if people were just to drink to thirst, we'd be okay.
Fascinating. So we've just got another minute. I want to ask you, there are so many different really intriguing examples, some common, some not so common. But I just want to ask you, what was one of the more outlandish or surprising claims in practice that you learned about and may have experimented on for yourself?
Well, I didn't try any of the things that seemed particularly outlandish, but I found, particularly in Colorado, there are people who are selling these shots of oxygen, like that was going to help you. And I thought, you know, this is ludicrous and ridiculous.
Why?
We are at
high altitude after all.
We are at high altitude. And absolutely, if you are someone who is having trouble with the altitude, you know, this is why people are on oxygen. But if you're an athlete, you are not having trouble breathing. And this is just not going to do much for you.
So one or two takeaways for listeners?
Yeah, learn to read your body. Listen to what it's saying. I think the most important skill that any athlete can develop is the ability to really read their own body's cues, what it feels like to be recovered, what fatigue feels like, what it feels like to go over the edge.
Good tips. Christy Ashwanden, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be back.
That was journalist Christy Ashwanden discussing her new book. It's called Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. She's the lead science writer at 538, and she'll speak about her book tonight, in fact, at the Boulder Bookstore at 7:30. And she'll also speak tomorrow night, February 6th, in Fort Collins at Old Firehouse Books, starting at 6. That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Beth Bennett.
This week's show is produced by Susan Moran and engineered by Maeve Conran. Additional contributions from Beth Bennett.
Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music from Survivor.
Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
Questions or comments, call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Susan Moran.
And I'm Gretchen Wetstein.